Chris is Chinese-American. He is HIV positive. He has a significant Christian ministry, and his mother travels with him to look after his needs. Chris's parents are academics. They came to the States to earn money and send it to the family back home. That's a common enough story, isn't it? And shortly after arriving, his father got a letter from China, which basically said, "Where's the money? You know, are you settling in? Where's the money? Where's the money?" So Chris's father lived to get the money. Chris's mother brought him up with three vital lessons for life, and they went something like this as Chris understood them. Honor your mother and father, be a good student, learn the piano. They became something of a dysfunctional family. Chris got through school, went to university, started taking drugs and dropped out. His mother persuaded the uni to reinstate him, but he quickly dropped out again. And how? He started living out a homosexual lifestyle. He organized gay pride marches and massive gay parties. And at the same time, he became a drug dealer big time. He had very little contact with his parents. But meanwhile, they got converted. They started going to marriage counseling. They began to learn how to live together as husband and wife. One day they visited Chris in his home, and as they were leaving, aware that very little real communication had taken place, they just left a Gideon's Bible on the table. Chris saw it as they were going out, picked it up, was furious, "How dare they in my own home?" and threw it at them as they were heading through the back door. He missed, and the Bible landed up in a waste paper basket. Well, the next time he contacted his parents was when he rang from jail. He'd been busted for drug dealing. He had a standard medical in prison with blood tests and so on, and the nurse said to him at the end, across a table they were seated at, she said, "Look, I'm sorry, I'm new to this. Someone else really should be here doing it today. I don't know how to say this. I've never done it before." And she just wrote on a piece of paper and passed it to Chris, and he read what she'd written, HIV positive. That's how he found out. He said his whole world collapsed at that moment. "I'm going to get ill and die," he thought. As he shuffled back to his cell because both hands and feet were cuffed, he saw a blue book sticking out of a waste paper basket and bent down and picked it up. It turned out to be a Gideon's New Testament, like the one he'd thrown at the back of his parents and had landed in the waste paper basket. He read it. It converted him. Pretty much all he knew about God had come from gay pride marches and the banners some people brought to them, "God hates fags, homosexuals will burn in hell." He started reading the Bible and discovered it told of a God who said to him, "I love you." There was no one to say anything or to teach him. He just read his Bible. So it took a while before he realized that an active gay lifestyle wasn't what pleased God, wasn't really compatible with a holy life. And since then, he's battled to live celibately. Now he's on the staff at Moody Bible College. He travels with his mum and his story to tell. I'm telling you this because if Chris had gone back in time and been living in Corinth, he wouldn't have stuck out that much. But also because his story vividly illustrates the first of two or three lessons that have struck me as I've been looking at this chapter the last week or two. Lessons Paul's got for us about Christian ministry. Here's the first of them. What I've called the combat zone for his ministry. Come and look at verses 3-5. Did you spot as Verena read it? It's full of military metaphors. The apostle speaks of waging war, of weapons, of demolishing strongholds, of taking captive. It's all military talk. Well, you can't do ministry without engaging with the enemy, the evil one, Satan. But at the same time, he's very clear about the dangers of military language. So he spells out the negatives twice. They're there in verse 3. we do not wage war as the world does. And he says it again in verse 4, doesn't he? The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. So no incitement to jihad here in the sense of guns or bombs or suicide jackets. No room either for those other weapons of the world, which too many in Corinth carried on them, rhetoric and manipulation and half-truth. Certainly warnings for Christian campaigners today. The real lesson I want us to see is this. Every war has its battlefield, some more decisive than others, and every battle has its combat zone where the fight is won and lost. And in the war of Christian ministry, the decisive battlefield, the combat zone where a life is won or lost, is the mind. The mind. That's what he's talking about here. Look at verse 5. We take captive every thought. John Stott once wrote a booklet called Your Mind Matters. Not because Christianity is an intellectual exercise any more than it's just all about having the warm fuzzies, but because Christianity is about transforming lives. And if lives are to be transformed, minds need to be captured for Christ. I mean, think back to Chris's story. It's easy to tell, but imagine the battle for his mind in that prison cell. The mindset changes that were needed, the attitudes that had to be altered, the deeply rooted thought patterns that had to be transformed before he's freed from drugs. He's altered his sexual lifestyle. Perhaps most deep-seated of all, he's restoring relationships with his parents. And the weapons that did this? Well, the Word of God in his prison cell. Actually, not even all the Word of God to begin with. Fascinatingly, scratched on the bottom of the bunk above Chris's so that he could see it every time he laid down was Jeremiah 29, verse 11. For I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. Jeremiah 29, verse 11. And Chris knew it was a Bible reference. And again, he leafed through his Gideon's New Testament, wondering why he couldn't find it. But the Word of God was at work in his mind, as were the prayers of his parents. They were the weapons that changed his life. So if you come to All Souls, we'd love you to experience the warmth of genuine Christian fellowship. We'd love you to know the joy of praising God together, but bring your minds when you come. I'd love to capture your heart, but I'm speaking to capture your head too. The combat zone of ministry, our minds. Now, even more striking to me was this second lesson, the confidence in his ministry. Look back again at verses 3 to 5. For though we live in the world, he says, verse 3, and there's no thought of retreat for Paul, that's where we're meant to be, however tough it is. Though we live in the world, he speaks in verse 4 about weapons, and he says they have divine power to demolish strongholds. They're fit for purpose. And this is the demolishing they do, verse 5. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. I don't know how you respond to the challenge of a hostile culture, whether you've got the confidence that the gospel is a match for the thought patterns around us. A friend of mine once put it this way, you can describe responses in terms of different animals. Now, which one best represents you? Are you the chameleon, you know, who will absorb every new idea and change colors to fit in? Are you the ostrich, buries his head in the sand and pretends it's not happening? Are you the porcupine? You're just very prickly about anything and everything. Or are you the lion, who will roar and take on any new idea? Many of us, I suspect, tend to shrivel and compartmentalize our faith, keep it for the safer parts of life, like church and possibly home. But Paul isn't the leader of some narrow sect. Paul goes into the synagogue with his faith. He goes into the courtroom and defends his faith. He fronts up to civil governors and explains his faith. He takes on academia and reasons for his faith on Mars Hill. Take every thought captive for Christ. He's not going to allow this gospel to be locked away behind the closed doors of home or church. Well, it's a challenge for us in the 21st century in the UK, because our culture seems to me to feature an increasing divide between public and private, between truths, they may not be totally defined, but truths that are for the public square, truths that shape the way public life operates, and values that are fine, and we're entitled to hold them, and they can be a credit to us, but they're really for the personal and private lives. And increasingly, these private values seem to have to be left at home when it comes to the public square. It seems to be the model that all our recent governments have begun to operate off. It seems to me to be behind their recent consultation on same-sex marriage. See, put yourself in their shoes for a moment. Their proposals leave room for private values, because they're proposing two kinds of marriage: civil marriage for the public square, the registry office, hotels, and so on, open to same-sex couples, and religious marriage in church, which will not be open to same-sex couples. And they say to those whose faith position would oppose same-sex marriage, you can hold your values. You can practice them. You can keep them still. We've provided for you. They seem sometimes to go on and say, so we don't actually need to listen to any of your arguments because of that. What they don't understand is that we don't believe in values. We're not fighting to keep our values. I mean, no one's proposing anything that stops us living out heterosexual marriage. We're fighting to demolish strongholds. Arguments, pretensions against the knowledge of God. We believe there's a reality about the true God which explains human nature, shapes human relationships, and belongs among public square truths, which is why we mustn't lobby the way the world does. We take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. We're not looking for people to share our values, but to share our Christ. That's the work of the evangelist, isn't it? And we can all chip in thought by thought by thought as we explain Christ, a Christ who, as Chris discovered, loves us whatever our starting point. The weapons of the gospel have the power to change individual lives like Chris's and to transform societies. I mean, do learn history or we'll forget the encouragement. In the Roman Empire, in the Reformation, in the UK in the 18th century, societies that were far darker than ours is now, churches that are far weaker, and yet transformed. Take captive every thought for Christ. Now, it's not just a word for the outsider, of course. It's a word for the insider too. Because this isn't the talk of the kind of evangelist who will happily settle for someone saying, I believe in Jesus. He wants every thought you have at work, or in the family, or with our neighbors, or at leisure, or in church life, captured for Christ. I mean, here's a confidence that won't brush issues under the carpet, that won't separate how I bring up my kids or how I do business from how I live my Christian life. Won't shrug either and settle for less, or say we can't expect any more from him or her. The question in front of us, I think, is do we have the gospel confidence to live together as that kind of community? The combat zone of ministry are minds. The confidence for ministry. Take every thought captive for Christ. And that leads neatly to the last lesson for us this morning, what I've called the character of his ministry. Now, If you look at the chapter more closely, you'll keep finding traces of two groups that Paul has in mind as he writes. There's the core Corinthian Christians, and there are newcomers, infiltrators. He can't really bring himself to call them Christians, and he'll label their leaders super apostles and then false apostles in the next chapter. They're the people, well, in verse 2, they're the some people. In verse 6, theirs are the every act of disobedience. By verse 12, they are the some who commend themselves. So when Paul picks up his pen to write these chapters, he's writing to defend his ministry from their slanderous attacks, to expose the way others use the weapons of this world in their ministry, to remind us all not to rush into admiration of ministers or ministries. For as he puts it in the last verse of the chapter, you saw it there in verse 18, it's not the one who commends himself who's approved, but the one whom the Lord commends. Well, there's no rush to admire Paul in Corinth. His style didn't fit their stereotype of a leader. He didn't come up to expectations. It happens. I can well remember a church house party I was speaking at a while back, and a lady came up to me halfway through and thanked me for a talk I'd given and said it was helpful and it was interesting and even that it was a real encouragement. And then what was clearly at the front of her mind came out. She said, "You're not as strong or forceful as I expected you to be." You know, she'd got an idea of what the rector of a large name church must be like, and I obviously didn't fit the bill. And no one had really trained me what you say when someone says something like that to you. And I remember I just mumbled something vaguely like, you know, "I'm sorry to disappoint you." Well, Paul didn't fit the bill either. You see, he was weak, at least weak when it really mattered, according to his critics. That's what he's implying, isn't it, in verse 1. "I, Paul, who am timid when face to face with you, but bold towards you when away." He spells it out more clearly in verse 10. "For some say," oh yeah, the other lot, "some say his letters are weighty and forceful, but in person he's unimpressive and his speaking amounts to nothing." See, that was the charge against him. When the rubber hits the road, weak. It's a difficult charge to answer if you think about it. I mean, do you write a soft reply? Well, it just adds fuel to the fire. Now he's weak in his letters as well as in person. Do you push back fiercely? It just confirms the charge. Fierce enough in writing, but he's a pussycat in person. Not sure that Paul and a pussycat go together too quickly in your mind, do they? But that was the charge. So Paul explains his ministry. He unlocks his leadership style. And as he does so, he teaches us about Christian leadership. And many, many of us are involved in that at one level or another. But he actually teaches us about leadership in any sphere as well. Here's some of the factors he touches on. Humility is not weakness. And it's fatal to muddle the two as the false teachers in Corinth had. Paul's leadership style is not driven by weakness. See how he opens the chapter? See where verse 1 begins? "By the humility and gentleness of Christ, I appeal to you." We live in the world, but we need to take every thought, even every thought on leadership, captive to Christ. Don't imagine because you're in big business and it works that you have seen, or because you're up on business management, you have at your fingertips the model of what leadership should look like. It works itself out for Paul like this. He's not interested in spiritual one-upmanship. He longs in verse 2 that the Corinthians sort themselves out. That's why he's written how he has. He's reasoned and argued and persuaded and opened his heart to them and pleaded with them. Their obedience doesn't have to come with him standing over them, cracking a whip like the great leader who saved the day. The good of the Corinthians is more important than who's getting the credit. In fact, he'll put up with others twisting his motives and slandering him if that's what it takes. Rather like Jesus, by the humility and gentleness of Christ. See, Paul suggests that what's going on is a discipleship issue and not just a leadership issue. He wonders, you've got to wonder, haven't you, if those new teachers would have spotted Jesus' leadership as he stood meekly and silently before Pilate, as he was nailed to a cross, as he was mocked mercilessly by the Good Friday crowd. The humility that suffers the cross for the good of those you've come to serve, that's at the heart of all true leadership. And it's not weakness. Here's something else about humility. Humility is right self-assessment. Right self-assessment. Romans 12 warns us, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober, clear-headed judgment. Well, Corinth struggled with that. Dazzled by the new teachers, they were more impressed by the cosmetic than by the substance. So he has to say what he does in verse 7. You're judging by appearances, which is a fatal flaw in leadership. I was given a fascinating article a few months back. It was entitled, The 7 Habits of Spectacularly Unsuccessful Executives. It's an analysis of flawed business leadership. I confess it was only a couple of days back that it suddenly dawned on me it might have been a hint. 7 Habits of Spectacularly Unsuccessful Rectors, but I just read it in all innocence. Here was habit number 5. You know these CEOs, high-profile executives who are constantly in the public eye. The problem is that amid all the media frenzy and accolades, these leaders' management efforts become shallow and ineffective. Instead of actually accomplishing things, they often settle for the appearance of accomplishing things. He speaks of them as blatant attention seekers. Well, at Corinth, these new teachers aren't just blatant attention seekers. They believe their own publicity. You know, verse 12, look at it. We do not dare to classify or compare ourselves with some who commend themselves when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves. You know, it's as if they write references for each other and give each other little sort of puff piece quotes. One Yeki will tell you that I am the greatest rector he's known. So I'll tell you how One Yeki is very insightful and perceptive, you know. And by the time we finish that, you think your judgments were all wrong before. Now, when people do that, you notice how verse 12 ends? They are not wise. See, it proves Paul was a Brit. Well, he mastered British understatement. They are not wise. But when you get inflated self-assessment, the temptation for some is to respond in kind, isn't it? And for others to think less of themselves than they should. You know, I don't compare, I'm worthless, I'm a nobody. It can happen in a place like All Souls. There are big personalities, big talents around. You don't actually even need that, do you? Sometimes it's little trivial things that pull the rug from under our sort of self-esteem. I don't know about you, I was in the rectory the other day, the post came through the door. And I like getting a letter, don't you? I kind of feel, you know, I sort of matter. And here it was in the sort of one of those red rubber bands, and I pulled that off, and I started turning them over to see who got a letter, and Claire had the first one, she's my wife, that's fine. And then my daughter, who's living with us, she got one, and her husband got one. But there were still a couple of left, and I was hopeful that these must be for me. And I turned the next one over, and that was for John Stott. I thought, at least I've got the last one, and I turned that over, and that was for Richard Bewes, who hadn't lived there for 7 years. And I was left with nothing. Then, you know, the heart sank and you think, oh, you're tempted just to sort of crawl into your shell and hide. And we can even make that sound like humility. But it's not Christian humility. And Paul's determined to take every thought captive for Christ. So he responds neither by inflating his importance nor pretending he's a nobody. He's got some great lessons, actually, for compiling a CV with integrity. See, look at verse 12. We, however, will not boast beyond proper limits. but will confine our boasting to the sphere of service God has assigned to us. We're not going to hang on to someone else's coattails and boast of what they've done. Church growth in Judea will not feature on the apostle's CV because he was commissioned as an apostle to the Gentiles. But it's a sphere that also, he says, includes you. The church plant at Corinth rightly does belong on Paul's CV. And by the way, the new teachers have no right to claim it as their achievement. Or look at verse 16. We do not want to boast about work already done in someone else's territory. He wants his record to be strictly honest. And appearances can be deceptive here, can't they? All my ordained ministry has been spent serving in big name successful churches. My brother-in-law is rector of three obscure little villages in Hampshire. All my ministry, I've inherited gospel congregations others have built up. My brother-in-law came to a small church with only a tiny handful of gospel believers. And he's turned it round, and he's grown it, and he's built it up over 20 years' hard work. Right self-assessment needs to look deeper than the surface, And it must never forget verse 17. Let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. Here's the last lesson about humility. Humility points to the Lord. See, even when his integrity is keeping him honest and assessing himself within the right limits, you sense Paul is uneasy putting his CV together. If he can only put one thing down, it would be this: it's the Lord's work. I think I've probably lost track over the years the number of times I've been asked or heard others asked, you know, what makes all souls what it is? And the great temptation is to start the answer with, John Stott, but we do John a disservice. And we insult our God if we don't begin with the Lord. The Lord gave life. The Lord made his light shine in people's eyes. The Lord has given the growth. Let him who boasts boast in the Lord. It's a quote from Jeremiah, and if you go back there, you'll find it's the Lord speaking to his people, and what he actually says in full is this: let the one who boasts boast about this, that they have the understanding to know me. And if I'm full of myself or full of other people, I'll never know God. They have the understanding to know me, that I'm the Lord who exercises kindness, justice, and righteousness on earth, for in these I delight. To know God is to know what delights him. And the leadership and the ministry which has God's approval will lead with kindness and justice and righteousness. The combat zone for ministry are minds. The confidence for ministry: take every thought captive for Christ. The character of ministry: humility. But it's not weakness.